Good day. Today is October 7th, 2007. I am Alicia Bryant, and I'm a cadet at the California Maritime Academy. I'm interviewing Keith Graham, who was born September 19th, 1952. This interview is being recorded by Benjamin Bolin, on the California training ship, or on board the training ship Golden Bear. So, Captain Graham, why did you decide to join the military?
Let's see. There was a very unpopular war on, and everybody was trying to get out of going, and I was interested in going. I'm from a long line of military folks, and I actually had a heart condition that would have kept me out, and it took me about a year and a half to get the appropriate medical waivers to get in, and so I actually, at that time, they were short, very junior officers in the Navy. My father had been a World War II CB. I had a great grandfather who was a scout for General Lee, for whom I'm named Keith Forrest Graham after Nathan Bedford Forrest. And so I wanted to join, and it just took a while. And so I actually received a direct presidential commission. Wow. They said, "Boom! You're an O-1. You're an ensign in the line of the Navy." Uh-huh. And I took my commission that way. And later on, after the Vietnam War, they were sending all of the junior officers home. Everybody that was an O-3 and below was essentially being cashiered out of the peacetime Navy. And all this happened before I even had a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. I had done well in school, such that I had been actually accepted by a law school in advance of having completed my bachelor's. And so the Navy allowed me to switch to the JAG Corps. I started over again as an O-1. I'd been a Navy a line O-1, and then switched to the JAG Corps. And I was an ensign in the JAG Corps for 2 full years, and in the as a Lieutenant JG for 2 years, and as a Lieutenant for 5 years in the JAG Corps. But that actually worked to my benefit in the long run. So that's how I got into the military.
All right. And do you think it was a good step for you?
The Navy fulfilled a lot of my needs. Mm-hmm. I left home at a very early age, as my students know, and not recommended. But in any event, I was self-supporting, and the Navy became somewhat of a family, profession, religion, mm-hmm. everything. It was the complete answer for me at the time. And I ultimately did 23 and a half years active in reserve in the Navy and retired as a captain.
Wow. So did you end up getting your law degree in the military?
Well, yes. Again, I hadn't been on active duty long enough to get into a paid program in the Navy JAG Corps. There were people that were placed on excess leave that were fully funded and went through law school on the government nickel. The Navy said, "Well, you can go on to law school, but you have to pay your own way." Well, that was okay. It wasn't the best deal in the world. It was the only one I qualified for, and so I was kept on for pay and promotion purposes, longevity. I didn't earn a dime unless I went on active duty and on mm-hmm. Christmas vacation or summer sessions. But for the next promotion board, I was always eligible, mm-hmm. and those years all counted for accrued service. So again, I was able to retire at I think before my 43rd birthday.
Okay.
As a captain.
What was it that drew you to the JAG program?
I think it was the perspective maybe that being a legal professional would help me out of the situation I was in terms of having left home and being a little hungry all those years and self-supporting and viewed, lawyers were certainly viewed more positively in society than maybe they are today.
Mm-hmm.
So probably when I was a junior in high school, about that time I decided that probably my target was to be a lawyer at some point, and I was able to meld the military desire to serve with the legal experience.
And how did you become associated with CMA?
Oh, well, the first time I ever heard about CMA was probably about 1971 or 72, and I was down to Monterey, going to Monterey Peninsula College, before going to Santa Clara, and the fella, and I affiliated with Sea Scouts as an older advisor, and the fella, nonetheless, that taught me to sail, mm-hmm. was the best natural-born sailor I ever ran into, and he announced one day that he was going on to the California Maritime Academy in Vallejo. And I said, "The what? You know, I'm a native Northern Californian. I'd never heard of it."
Right.
And that's certainly a similar story that many people have to tell. But Dennis Welch, and Dennis ultimately graduated from the academy, became a bar pilot, you know, has probably earned more money than all of us in the room many times over following that profession. But he was a great sailor, and he came here, and I never made contact with him except sort of vicariously. But then time passes, and the events described that I described to you occurred. And in 1975, while on excess leave, again going to law school at Santa Clara, I had an opportunity to start teaching for what back then we called CME, Continuing Maritime Education, which today they call extended learning is the second part of that. Special projects and extended learning.
Mm-hmm.
Back then it was called CME, and I had the opportunity to start teaching for CME, doing seminars in international law.
Okay.
And again, I'm still in law school, I'm a naval officer, I have sort of almost the right credentials to be doing this in seminars in the city. Back then, CME rented major hotel space and did these sponsored these seminars on the weekend, and then the Maritime Academy had a campus down at the foot of Fort Mason,
mm-hmm.
Actually where the Jeremiah O'Brien used to tie up, and it was the Radar Observer School,
mm-hmm.
and I would teach there when I needed classroom space and otherwise in hotels, and then in 1977, one of my mentors in the Navy was teaching here and did a prototype class in international law on campus, and I became a guest speaker in that class, and then took that class over in 1979. I came from sea on the USS Kansas City in 1978 to Mare Island to be stationed there for ultimately 4.5 years. And then, so I came over in 79 and asked Admiral Rizza if I could have a class on campus, and he was wise enough to say, "Why, you're in the military, you're already paid, if you'll do it for free, you can teach." And I did that for 3 years and actually expanded my repertoire from just international law or international maritime law to also teaching, back then was contract law and specifications was the second course that I was teaching for the engineering department, one for the deck and one for the engineering, which were our only 2 degrees then,
mm-hmm.
In that vintage.
So you taught your first 3 years without being paid.
That's right. That's right. And it was worth it. And still worth it in retrospect.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So you were full-time military and also taught at the same time. How was it coordinating everything?
I had a day class, and I would I taught in the old engineering. Well, actually, my original class was where Commodore Keever's office is now. It was a very small simulator, and I had 15 people. The admiral said that he would try an experimental on-campus class of 15 people, and I still actually hear from people in that original class,
really?
After all these years,
wow.
Along with any number of folks that just know to drop me a letter from time to time or exotic port and say, "Gee, I'm here, and you know what you taught me was really true," or you know, thought your kids would like to see.
Interesting. So, did you ever become full time faculty, or is it always just
no? I've always been an adjunct faculty all these years, and I've taught in 7 different departments at CMA, depending on the classes I've taught. And I have a list of those, if I can read those into the record, because I can't remember them. I wrote them down, and let's see if I can. Okay, well, DEC, which has since become Maritime Management, Marine Engineering, and I sailed actually because I taught contract law and specifications, which was a Marine Engineering course. I actually sailed as a member of the Engineering Department to Expo 86.
Mm-hmm.
What were they thinking? I'm currently in the Business Department. I taught for the Naval Science Department, and I'll expand on that subsequently. General Studies, Mechanical Engineering, and the Facilities Engineering program. I did distance learning as well as engineering ethics for them.
Which has been your favorite department to teach in, you think?
I would have to follow the course, which is winded its way through various departments. International law, or what I teach is international maritime law, is the course, again, that I inherited from my mentor, Captain Jack Glazier, and still happily teach that one as often as I can.
So, what effect did the civil rights movement have here at CMA? How did the campus change after African Americans began attending?
I'm going to remember that a year before I arrived on campus, again coming over from Mare Island, but the first African American, Kim Estes, was here or graduated. I don't remember exact, because I wasn't here. I was at sea most of that year, but Kim, I think, is still affiliated with the Academy in terms of special programs and maybe Industrial Advisory Board and what have you, and a fine individual. We're in Northern California, okay, and having an African American may have been significant to somebody. It was, the military pretty much makes you colorblind. I served with the Army, and the Army has a saying in wartime that the most important person is the person on your right and the person on your left, and you don't care what color they are.
Right.
So, in terms of the civil rights movement, I wouldn't see that as having a big bow wave on campus. Mm-hmm. Now, subsequent individual, and I can't remember the year that he started. And I honestly, I'm embarrassed to say, I can't remember his last name. Edwin was the first Black Corps commander,
mm-hmm.
and you know, socialized with him, and thought he was again a fine individual. It wasn't so much, oh, here's the novelty of, oh gee, we have somebody to show off, but it was an achievement in that sense, in a larger historical sense.
Mm-hmm.
Probably even as when I was at Santa Clara undergraduate, we had the first woman corps commander in the Army ROTC on campus, and you know, that got a lot of coverage. But you know, those are just early milestones that, in retrospect, important at the time and less significant as we are better integrated. Women, the first class of women had graduated, I believe, the year before I arrived on campus to teach, and. What I noted among the early, there were few in number women coming here at the time I started teaching, and they were all enormously bright. I mean, they were the ones that could be guaranteed to get A's in my class. And I hope that's not a terrible overgeneralization, but they were very, very sharp as a group. They were small, they in number, and sort of looked out for themselves, and in that respect were a microcosm or society within a larger society. But I remember them as all enormously smart individuals that sort of disproportionate to their numbers collected the A's in my classes. And so I remember them somewhat vividly, because they were few in number. Now, I don't know what the current statistics are for women. I think it's probably between 20 and maybe approaching 40%. It seems like maybe that's overly large. And today, I think women maybe as a group have some issues yet to disarm with their male counterparts, which certainly needs to be done, but. They are not, I'm going to say, special or placed on a podium or something like that as being unique to the industry or one-off. Some of the folks that I've stayed in touch with will tell me, more recent graduates tell me when they go to an alumni meeting that, you know, they're still, you know, in the eyes of some of these folks that were the old Merchant Marine, the World War II Merchant Marine, and what have you. Gee, do they have gals now at the Maritime Academy? And they obviously aren't reading their alumni news for the last 40 years or 30 years. So I guess I don't have a statement as to the place women stake out today at the Academy, other than they're mainstream, which I think is as it should be.
So how was CMA affected by the Cold War?
There was, well, we got this nice ship when the Cold War was over, and there was no need for the Military Sealift Command to use it as a cable tapping ship anymore. There was a lot of relation to the more people, let's say, graduated from naval science and took active duty military degrees, not just the or commissions, not just the folks that are in the MMR program. I mean, people went into the Coast Guard, people went into the Navy, Navy Line, Naval Aviation. People went into the Marine Corps. Larger fractional share of the graduating class went active duty military, and that's now a rarity today. When I go to commissioning now, most of the folks that are getting a commission are going to be purely reserve commission versus reserve on active duty. So the Cold War was a stimulus to get folks, graduates, into the military. I think we, it's probably a truism that we graduate folks that are better educated in terms of shipboard knowledge and understanding. I think they compete very, very favorably with the other, let's say, line and officers in the fleet in terms of their knowledge of shipboard life and navigation and engineering. So a good tradition there. The Merchant Marine program here, the Naval Science program, has had good vitality. It was the only program here when I got here, and now there is a Coast Guard equivalent, which I think of the two is actually the more popular in terms of numbers. Mm-hmm. But again, most of the folks are not going to be going active duty.
And which training cruises did you go on, and which one was memorable?
Let's see. Well, I went on one, mm-hmm. so it was my most memorable. And that was Expo 86. I took my wife and my two-year-old daughter, who charmed everybody because she was so gregarious and so darn smart. And we went on the old Golden Bear and sailed up to Vancouver, and where we'd rented a room in an old, made advanced reservations to stay at an old hotel, Victorian type, wood exterior, wood shingle exterior hotel, and then go to a World's Fair. I mean, not everybody, I hadn't been to a World's Fair before, and so it was memorable in that respect. And my daughter, honestly, has memories of that event. It was, even at two, it etched in her mind, and so she can recount some things that happened on that trip. Again, I sailed as part of the engineering faculty on the old Golden Bear. We were in stateroom that had the Ritz. We were in the Ritz stateroom, which was forward and on the starboard side of the old Golden Bear. And I had no trepidation for myself, but sometimes I looked at that vessel and said, is my wife and baby daughter going to be okay? But we had a wonderful time in Vancouver, British Columbia, and did a number of site trips, and then came back. Captain Kiever then was the ship driver, and we in part justified going by showing some California agricultural products, including wine, and had an open house on the vessel as an adjunct to the World's Fair.
Okay. What was the most memorable part of the World Fair? What did you enjoy most?
Oh, I mean, memorable things were like the fireworks every night, because they didn't really, but they had a village that had waterworks like you might see at Versailles or Petrograd, St. Petersburg, and it was pretty amazing. And I guess I was struck by how much everybody was proud of their country.
All right. Let's see. Did you ever participate in the Navy Reserve? To what extent did you participate in the Navy Reserve while you were here at CMA?
In one respect, pretty significantly. Now, one of the things I did while in the Naval Reserve was continue to do seminars on my weekend drills. And so I would take officers of the Sea Service, the Coast Guard, the Marine Corps, and the Navy, and do a weekend training session in international maritime law. I would be able to offer them the opportunity to get credit, these continuing education units, through CME for essentially going to their Naval Reserve or Coast Guard drill and stuff. And so I actually ended up training about 1,500 Sea Service officers on my weekend drills, offering them again credit through CME. During Desert Storm, Desert Shield, excuse me, during Desert Shield, I actually had so many folks that otherwise had a military nexus here, students and faculty. I changed my reserve site. I was drilling then in Sacramento, and I actually officially got my reserve site changed, the UIC, the Unit Identification Code, to the Naval Science Department at CMA. And on weekends, I would do wills and powers of attorney for people that were deploying. Mm-hmm. And then I myself was activated for Desert Storm. And although it was a very short war, mm-hmm. it was over in 3 weeks, I think. But during Desert Shield, I did an awful lot of wills and powers of attorney as a reserve Navy JAG. I was always friends with whoever was the officer in charge of the Naval Science Department here, starting with Ken Dunning. And a series of folks subsequent to him. I would do the Uniform Code of Military Justice lecture for them if asked, and you know, they would graciously invite me to their dining inn if they had one. So I feel I've had a good strong relationship with them. Let me see if I noted anything else. No, I think that's it.
Did any of the people that you trained through the Navy Reserve ever end up coming to CMA?
Well, they would have fundamentally been officers already, so they would have had an undergraduate degree, but a fair amount of my CMA students here ended up in the Navy and the Navy Reserve, and I mean, it's very rewarding to have at graduation to see somebody walking around that's a captain in the Navy Reserve, you know, when you remember them as a student. Mm-hmm. And then my last couple of years in the Navy Reserve, I actually drilled voluntarily with a Merchant Marine Reserve unit that had a lot of CMA alums in it. And I also drilled at Military Sealift Command Pacific for some of my 2 week active duties. And anytime I walked into MSCPAC, there were always CMA grads, you know, waiting to pick up a ship, and it was always, "Hey, Uncle Keith, hey, Uncle Keith."
It's very rewarding. And how has CMA changed, and when did it become a part of the CSU system? Or has it changed since then?
Well, from probably 1926, when the school was started, if that's the right year, I think it is, 26 or 29. To 1996, CMA was actually an independent state agency in and of itself. It wasn't per se part of the educational system. In fact, not long before I got here, it was still a 3-year unaccredited institution. So I mean, it was a trade school, but more importantly, its status as an independent state agency. Whenever there was a budget cut in the state, it took it out of hide. There was no place to absorb except out of flesh. And this place literally was living hand to mouth for many, many years, and you know, was subject to being blue penciled off the budget some year when it would have been a cost savings measures or a political expediency. And so in 1996, when really of necessity we merged with the CSU system, even though we were probably the smallest campus, we immediately got a lot more flush in terms of monies available. We went on a very vigorous building program. You look around the campus and see what we built since 96. We got this ship in 96, not because we were CSU, but because we knew how to ask, and had friends in the Maritime Administration. So it's been a good affiliation in the sense of making the campus more viable and bringing more programs to it to be part of CSU.
What negatives do you see as a result of joining CSU?
It's the other side of the sword. You become, let's say, more mainstream CSU. You start becoming just another campus. Well, CMA will never be just another campus of CSU, but we start walking, talking, and acting like other CSUs, and we're thought of as part of the system-wide campus. And the business, and maybe that's a Freudian slip, but the business of education has changed into a business. Mm-hmm. And I see, and this may be a trend for education nationwide, I don't know, but it has certainly become more corporately run, more run like a business organization since becoming part of CSU. Mm-hmm. I think that challenges our traditional image of ourself and what all of us old timers think CMA is about.
And do you think that the introduction of non-licensed programs contributed to this feeling?
Oh, too easily said. I'm delighted that we have as many majors and departments and programs as we do. CMA had to get bigger and become in terms of diversity and having multifarious opportunities for graduates. But it's just the tenor, let's say, of the administration from Long Beach, that gee, one size fits all in terms of how campuses are to respond to initiatives and change and mandates and things like that.
And so what was your most memorable event here at CMA and why?
Well, I've got three answers to that, actually, the things that I thought of. In 1998, after a couple of years of searching, and having found the surviving family of a Japanese master sergeant that perished in World War II in the Palau Islands, and having his personal effects picked up by a naval officer who gave them to his son, who was also a naval officer, who gave them to me with the admonition, gee, wouldn't it be nice to return these to his family? Mm-hmm. We did find the family and returned those effects on board Golden Bear, which put into Yokosuka. And there was a very nice ceremony. Of course, I wasn't on the ship. I have a full-time job, right? Mm-hmm. But I sent them with trusted folks, and Commodore Keever presided over that. And I thought that was a wonderful mission for Golden Bear.
Okay.
And then I would say an equally personally rewarding event happened by pure happenstance, and that would be there was a commissioning about 2001, and I ended up as the commissioning speaker because Frank Johnson, the day before, who's the local MARAD administrator, who's a fine individual and a great friend of the academy, had chest pains. Angina, was hospitalized, and he was slated to speak. And I got a call from the Naval Science Department administrator saying, Captain Johnson can't talk tomorrow. Could you? And I said, well, how long? And well, it's 15 minutes. And I said, okay. And I'll tell you, it's much harder to write a 15-minute speech than it is a two-hour lecture. And I had overnight to do it. But that was a good event. And I think the third event would be I always tried to assimilate my kids into teaching here. Mm-hmm. And I brought them into a number of forums. I started with my oldest daughter at 6 months and got her into class, and she would always sit right here. And she would sit through a whole lecture. I could, you know, a whole hour's lecture, we'd take a break, I'd take her out in the hall and feed her, and then we'd do another hour. And my second daughter, I was on the board of trustees here, and I took her one time to the old Chevron Shipping, you know, 25th floor at 455 Market Street, and she was just a little one, just learning to write. And here we are in a long, dreary board meeting, and Katie was learning her alphabet, and she did the entire alphabet on a yellow, you know, never too far from a yellow tablet, being a lawyer. And she had taken this, meticulously written out every letter, and then changed every letter into an animal. And over the course of that evening, people quit paying attention to what was the agenda items for the night. And they're all watching Katie do this, and she's just perfect, you know, being happy for all this time, you know, one letter at a time. And then the third one is somewhat legendary. It's almost unbelievable, except for the people that were there. And my son Brian was probably second grade, third grade, and he was a factoid buff. I mean, he would get, you know, the Guinness Book of whatever, and he would memorize it cover to cover, or geography books. And so I brought him one afternoon to an international law class and put him in the back row, and we started class, and somebody, you know, made a wisecrack about who's the new student. And I said, well, that's my son, Brian. And they said, well, is he, you know, essentially smart enough to sit through this class? And I said, yeah, he's pretty smart. You want to ask him something? And somebody said, okay, what's the population of Indonesia? And Brian, who's in second or third grade, says, which island? And he said, he went on to say the island of Java has 80 million people, the island of Sumatra has, you know, 40 million, and he was dead right. And they just, you know, said, and I said, I don't have to tell you to go to the library to check his facts, because I know he's right. So it's always been fun to have my kids in class. And they've always been perfect.
That's great. And they weren't ever tempted to come to CMA, or?
I had one that went to Notre Dame and thence to Stanford, and one that started at University of Portland, and one that hasn't made up his mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they've all been to CMA. They've all got time on station in the classroom at CMA.
That's good. So why have you stayed at CMA over 30 years now?
It's fun. It's my sanity break. As I said, I have a full-time day job that's well in excess of 40 hours. I always look forward to the start of every semester. I look forward to the start of every class. I'm excited for every class. That rush has never gone away. It's still fun. It's not always fun preparing, you know, every evening in advance of class, but when you get to class, it's just very, very good. And I hope I'm very good, but the evaluation says that at least the course material is interesting.
Well, that's good. So thinking back at CMA today, what you expected it would be when you started here?
It was a very small campus in the sense that everybody knew everybody else's business when I first showed up on campus, and it was almost too small. I mean, in that respect, there were. I shouldn't tell this story, but I will. Simply because we're trying to record history. I mentioned that this school, right before I got here, was still unaccredited in a three-year vocational school. There were faculty that actually fought accreditation because they didn't think they would be qualified to teach in a four-year institution. Now, for somebody that passes themselves off as an educator to fight college accreditation, there's a message there. And in some cases, there were people teaching here that because they had gone to sea in the Navy or some other military service, they thought, number one, that they were entitled to continued lifetime employment at CMA, and they didn't know anything about the Merchant Marine and weren't in a hurry to learn. So there was a small fractional share of people that probably shouldn't have been teaching here as part of a Merchant Marine Academy, and attrition got those folks over the years. That was part of this smaller organization. We're very diverse today, and that's healthy in terms of the faculty and the staff that you run in, and the student body too. You know, from your own experience, I made the statement in class. You know, this generation is colorblind. That's a huge issue. That's a huge milestone to have achieved. But the faculty today, you can find folks from all experiences, and they're well integrated. Our programs are robust. We're going to teach a master's program in China next year, with the Dalian Maritime Academy. That's 90% confidence level. I'll be part of that enterprise, teaching international maritime law the second year of a two-year degree. I mean, that's just unthinkable 30 years ago.
So with the master's program in China, are we actually sending our professors over to China?
The regimen would be that the classes would last a month. The first week would be distance learning. Mm-hmm. The middle 2 weeks would be time in country by the professor. And then the last week would be distance learning again. So every course would run out a month.
And is that just for Chinese students, or is it for...
It's for folks again, it's a master's program. It's people in industry. Mm-hmm. In China that are Chinese nationals.
Okay.
So if you live long enough, you see everything. I mean, you were asking about the Cold War, and one of the thoughts that I commented on in class last semester, a year before I came to the academy, we were clearing mines out of Haiphong Harbor, having mined them during the Vietnam War, and it would have been unthinkable to say that the Golden Bear would go on a cruise of friendship and goodwill.
Yeah. So do you see that being a trend for the future, working with other maritime academies around the world and developing master's programs and further friendship and goodwill?
I don't know. This is a huge pilot for the school, and I think it'll be a precursor of offering a master's program here. And I don't know if there'll be a cookie cutter effect to go academy to academy. Certainly, we had a strong relationship with the Admiral Makarov Maritime Academy in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. For a couple of years when Pavel Nabokov was here. Mm-hmm. An academy should be international or universal by definition anyway, that's devoted to the maritime trade. So I can see it happening. But China is a wonderful place to start.
And so as far as general trends for CMA, what do you foresee happening?
We're definitely on the ascendancy in terms of the number of students we're getting. It's just, between more people on campus and the more folks going on the cruise every year, it seems like with two 60-day cruises. When I started teaching here, we had trimesters. We had a fall, a spring, and we had summer at sea, essentially, and you went to sea for the entire summer, which wasn't as long as the other two trimesters, but it was much more truncated in terms of that experience. Everybody went, and that was that. Now you can go commercial cruise, or you can go the first cruise or the second cruise. I think we take folks from a couple other academies,
yeah,
and certainly other CSU members.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, that's it for my questions. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about or thought that was important?
Well, just with reference to my relationship to the law here, I started teaching law classes because that was something I was qualified to do. And along about 1982, I think, we offered for the first time the law option, which was somewhat like a minor in law. We didn't have minors per se, but we had options in a couple of classes. And so if you took enough classes that included independent study and what have you, you received an option, and I think William Schopp was the first individual that graduated with a law minor or a law option, and then that graduated or evolved into what we have today, which is the law minor program, one of five minors that the school offers. I administer that program, and I help people through the four classroom classes that they have to take, which is Admiralty and International Maritime Law, Maritime Environmental Law, Business Law, and an internship on some sort of law platform, a business, a law office, insurance, claims, maritime, something that puts them in a legal experiential role, and an independent study. But now, again, you do that, and you have a diploma at the time of graduation that says I did something that my peer that maybe I'm competing with in the marketplace doesn't have, that shows my commitment and some modest understanding at the undergraduate level of law. I have, at any given time, probably 12 people in that program. I would say 1 in 6 ultimately goes on to law school. Usually they get out of CMA, they go sail on their license for a few years. I think the average is 3 to 4. And then they're able to find me or come back to campus and say, gee, I need to pick out a law school, I need to take the LSAT, I'm ready to come shoreside, I've always wanted to go to law school and stuff. And we've had great success putting those folks at quality law schools. Tulane in particular has a good lineage of CMA students, graduates going through it. And I think today I have two folks at Tulane, one at Vermont Law School, which is got a maritime specialty, and a couple others at different points in their legal education in the United States. So that's always rewarding to have folks meet the ship when it's on a cruise and say, oh, gee, I went to sea and I took the law minor, and today I'm an admiralty attorney, or I'm just mm-hmm.
Do you see perhaps a law major being created at CMA, like admiralty law?
Hadn't thought about that. So
would it be something you'd like to
Oh, I definitely like to participate in that, but I'll throw it my way, and over the years have developed several courses, as you know, and mm-hmm. that's always fun. So, more opportunities to teach.
So, was there anything that you wanted to ask? And I believe we're finished.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.